Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Sarah Holstein, Associate Professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. I'm very pleased to be joined today by two of my colleagues, Dr. Mohamed Balyovich, who's an Assistant Professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and Dr. Natalie Callender, who's Professor at the University of Wisconsin. These are our disclosures. And these are the disclosures of the Planning Committee. Today, we will be discussing the current status of BCMA-directed therapies and the available data we have to support their use in the relapsed refractory myeloma setting. We'll start with an overview of BCMA and the three main classes of agents. We will review the efficacy of these agents, as well as discuss management strategies for their toxicities. We will conclude with a panel discussion about how to best integrate BCMA-directed therapy into clinical practice. And to start our discussion today with an overview of the current status of BCMA-directed therapies. So targeting BCMA in myeloma, where are we now and where are we going? First, as a brief background, this is the current therapeutic landscape for myeloma. We have our alkylating agents, but really the mainstay these days are the immunomodulatory drugs, which primarily include lenalidomide and pomalidomide, the proteasome inhibitors, including bortezomib, exazomib, carfilzomib, and the anti-CD38 monoclonal antibodies, which include daratumumab and isatuximab. We also have three other agents approved for myeloma, including this anti-SLAMF7 monoclonal antibody, a histone deacetylase inhibitor, and an XPO1 inhibitor. Once patients become refractory to CD38 antibody therapy, especially in combination with IMiDs or PIs, the management of these patients becomes very difficult. So I wanted to set the stage by discussing the data from the Mammoth study. This was a retrospective study of patients with myeloma that was refractory to CD38 antibodies from 14 different academic institutions. And overall, on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see that the median overall survival for this patient population is only 8.6 months. And in particular, when you look at the penta-refractory patients, which are refractory to lenalidomide, pomalidomide, bortezomib, carfilzomib, and an anti-CD38 antibody, you can see that the overall survival is even shorter at a median of 5.6 months. So this patient population represents a very difficult to treat patient population, and it is clear that we need new and improved treatment strategies, including new targets, in order to improve outcomes for these patients. So that brings us to BCMA, or the B-cell maturation antigen. This is a protein found on the cell surface of B-cells and plasma cells. BCMA, TACI, and BAFF receptor are all receptors belonging to the TNF receptor superfamily, and they bind BAFF and APRIL, which regulate B-cell survival. We'll be discussing this later on, but it's important to note that all three receptors can undergo proteolytic shedding. Notably, BCMA-deficient mice had no defects in B-cell homeostasis, but had impaired survival of long-lived plasma cells, showing the importance of BCMA for plasma cell survival. What do we know about BCMA in myeloma? Well, preclinical studies with mouse xenografts showed that tumor cells that had induced overexpression of BCMA grew more rapidly than BCMA-negative controls. In addition, when patient samples have been evaluated, either their plasma cells or serum BCMA levels, it's been shown that the highest levels of BCMA are found in active myeloma patients compared to samples from MGUS or untreated myeloma patients. Levels of serum soluble BCMA may correlate with prognosis and response to treatment as well, as shown as figure C on this slide. So currently there are three main approaches to targeting BCMA, and this will be the primary focus of today's talks. The first includes antibody drug conjugate therapy. This involves an anti-BCMA antibody that's conjugated to a cytotoxic agent. The second class that we'll be discussing are the bispecific T-cell engaging products. These products dually target BCMA on the plasma cell and then CD3 on the T cells in order to bring the two cell types close together to be able to facilitate T cell mediated cytolysis. And then finally, we will also be discussing BCMA directed chimeric antigen receptor or CAR T cells. So first, the anti-BCMA ADC. This is the agent belantamab mafodotin. This agent is an antibody directed against BCMA, which is linked via a cleavable linker to the antitubule agent MMAF. As shown here in this diagram, the antibody carries the toxic payload. The antibody binds to BCMA on the surface of the myeloma cell. The antibody gets internalized and then degraded within the lysosome, leading to release of the toxic payload within the myeloma cell. For the bispecific agents, first I'll start with the bispecific T-cell engagers. So this involves taking the antigen recognition domains from an anti-CD3 antibody and an anti-BCMA antibody and linking them together with a flexible linker. So as you can see, this then allows for this agent to bring together in close proximity the T cell via the CD3 moiety and the plasma cell via the BCMA moiety to enable T cell mediated cytolysis. Somewhat related but slightly different is the bispecific antibody approach. Here shown in the red box is the DuoBody approach, where you can see that the therapy is a complete antibody. However, half of the antibody has been derived from an anti-CD3 antibody, and the other half has been derived from an anti-BCMA antibody. Again, the result is the same. This allows for the T cell to be brought into close proximity with the BCMA-bearing malignant plasma cell. And then finally, we have our BCMA CAR T cells. The construct for the CAR is very similar to what has been used previously with B-cell lymphomas. Namely, there's a CD3 zeta signaling domain, a co-stimulatory domain, a hinge region, spacer, but then the antigen recognition part is directed against BCMA. So you have the T cell with this chimeric antigen receptor on the surface, which then recognizes BCMA on the surface of the malignant plasma cell. So those three classes represent the current direction of anti-BCMA therapy, but clearly there's many new directions that will lead to our future. Some of these involve the development of CAR and NK cells. There's also interest in the development of allogeneic BCMA CAR T cells, as this might provide an off-the-shelf option. There's also been interest in developing multi-targeted CAR T cells. For example, there was a recent publication in which the CAR T cells are directed against both BCMA and GPRC5D. A little bit later on in today's session, we'll be talking about the role of gamma secretase inhibitors. And then, as with everything else we do in myeloma, it is likely that we will move on to using all these BCMA therapies in combination with other myeloma drugs. So with that, it's my pleasure to now turn it over to Dr. Balyovich to talk about the efficacy of the BCMA-directed therapies.
Thank you very much, Dr. Holstein. It is my pleasure today to address several questions in this evolving field with Dr. Holstein and Dr. Callender. And over the next several slides, I will be talking about the efficacy of BCMA-directed therapy in myeloma and at what point we find ourselves at the moment with the available data. First, we will start by addressing the anti-BCMA antibody drug conjugate belantamab mafodotin. As Dr. Holstein mentioned, this is one of the earlier constructs that became available in targeting BCMA as an antigen. It's important also just to mention at the beginning that because of the breadth of expression of BCMA along the different stages of B-cell development, of course, this became a very attractive target for therapeutic purpose in multiple myeloma, but has not been the only target in terms of exploiting therapeutic potentials in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. Phase 1 DREAM-1 belantamab mafodotin study in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma already reported, and this was data that looked at individuals who had relapsed refractory myeloma, where 97% were PR refractory, out of which 77 had Kyprolis resistance or carfilzomib, 95% were IMiD refractory, out of which 63% were exposed and refractory to pomalidomide, and where 40% also were daratumumab, anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody refractory. After median follow-up of 12.5 months, overall response rates in the cohort of 35 patients was 60%, with stringent CR being 6%, complete response or CR 9%, and VGPR, or very good partial response, of 40%. So it is quite clear here that overall response rate stretched in the significant extent, and that median time to response was in fact fairly quick, 1.2 months, and median duration of response in this cohort was about just over 14 months. Another piece of data that was available with this study is that double refractory patients had slightly better overall response rate of 56% than triple refractory patients with IMiD-PI and anti-CD38 therapy refractoriness with an overall response rate of 38%. In this trial, two different doses of belantamab vedotin were explored, 2.5 and 3.5 milligrams per kilogram. Primary endpoint was overall response rates. Results showed an overall response rate of 31% with the 2.5 milligram dosing versus 34% with a higher 3.5 milligram per kilogram dosing. Dr. Callender will subsequently touch on some of the safety profiles of this and other BCMA therapies, but briefly we can mention that select grade 3-4 adverse events with 2.5 and 3.5 milligram dosing included keratopathy and thrombocytopenia, anemia, and notably two deaths that were reported as treatment-related at the 2.5 milligram dose, one being related to sepsis and the other being related to HLH. The final study we will discuss in anti-BCMA ADC subgroup is DREAM-6 study, which was conducted in relapse refractory multiple myeloma patients. This is an ongoing two-part, two-arm study evaluating the safety and tolerability and clinical activity of belantamab vedotin in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone and lenalidomide dexamethasone in patients previously treated with greater than or equal to one prior line of therapy. Here we're going to present the data of belantamab vedotin in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone. Part 1, which was dose escalation, and Part 2, which was dose expansion, evaluated belantamab at 2.5 and 3.5 milligram dosing, administered as single day 1 or split dose divided equally on days 1 and 8 in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone. At the 2.5 milligram per kilogram Q3 weekly dosing in the combination arm with belantamab, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, overall response rate was 78%, out of which 50% achieved very good partial response, and where a total clinical benefit, which was defined as response level greater than or equal to minor response and greater, was 83%. The median duration of response has not been reached yet at a median follow-up of just over 18 months. Most frequent adverse events were cytopenias, keratopathy. Again, Dr. Callender will be expanding further on. In terms of bispecific T-cell engager therapies that are targeting BCMA, an early candidate certainly was AMG-420 that was advanced in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma patient with an early phase trial where therapy was given in patient population with greater than or equal to two prior lines of therapy, including greater than or equal to one each of PI and IMiD. Patients with plasma cell leukemia, extramedullary disease, CNS involvement, and prior allogeneic stem cell transplantation were excluded, as is often the case. In the phase 1 dose escalation study, reported overall response rate was 70%, including 5 MRD negative responses. Unfortunately, the downside of this form of therapy was that this was involving a 4-week continuous infusion with an off week for two weeks for a total 6-week cycle, and there were additionally significant side effects, including peripheral neuropathy and the CRS grades, that ultimately were prohibitive for further development of this bispecific antibody. Subsequent to this, AMG-701 entered as a candidate in the anti-BCMA bispecific T-cell engager field. This is a molecule which has an extended half-life where weekly dosing is possible and where certainly side effects are still possible as well. The large phase 1 and 2 trial is currently underway and we're expecting to see further data soon. One of the novel agents inside the BCMA T-specific engager field is REGN5458, anti-BCMA and anti-CD3 bispecific antibody. This data was just recently presented at the ASH 2019 conference. Bispecific antibody has a different binding characteristics, and inside the phase 1 study, It was administered as a subcutaneous injection at 3 mg and 6 mg weekly dosing. Responses were seen in 4 out of 7 patients. At a 6 mg dose, where 4 patients were treated, overall response rate was in 3 out of 4 patients, with MRD negative response in 2 out of 4. This bispecific antibody had manageable toxicity profile with lymphopenia, anemia, and hypertension, and at the moment, dose escalation phase is currently ongoing. It's worth to note that some of these patients, in addition, had extramedullary disease involvement, and that the preliminary results actually demonstrated quite efficient resolution of some of the extramedullary in skin sites with plasma cell involvement. So this certainly is one of the promising newer anti-BCMA antibody therapies. Another candidate inside the anti-BCMA bispecific antibody is teclistamab, which targets anti-BCMA on myeloma cells as well as anti-CD3 on T cells. This clinical study involved 78 patients in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma patients. Median age was 64. Median number of prior therapies was 6, ranging anywhere from 2 to 14. And 72% of participants were triple class exposed, 62% were triple class refractory, and 51% were pentadrug refractory. Efficacy data at 720 microgram per kilogram dose are not mature yet, but at the 270 microgram per kilogram dosing, 7 out of 8 responders were triple class refractory and 5 out of 8 were pentadrug refractory. Overall response rate was 67%, with a greater than or equal to VGPR response rate of 50%. Response deepened over time, where 16 out of 21 patients who responded have an ongoing response. BCMA and CD3 bispecific antibodies such as this approaches offer often off-the-shelf immune-mediated therapy for patients that will certainly be available at a shorter time frame than potential CAR T-cell therapies that we'll be touching in a moment. Adverse events included CRS and cytopenias. CRS was 56%, mainly grade 1 and 2. There was a grade 3 or equal cytopenia rate that was also notable, and Dr. Callender will likely be expanding on some of these specifics in the coming slides. An anti-BCMA bispecific antibody of note also includes CC93269, which is a humanized anti-bivalent BCMA and an anti-monovalent CD3 ETA bispecific T-cell engager. This is an asymmetric two-arm humanized IgG T-cell engager that binds bivalently to BCMA and monovalently to CD3 in a 2+1 format. This early phase clinical trial involved dose escalation in two stages. In stage 1, CC93269 was given in a fixed dose. In stage 2, patients received fixed first dose on cycle 1, day 1, followed by interpatient dose escalation in cycle 1, day 8. Overall number of patients exposed in this trial was 30, where patients had to be relapsed refractory to at least 3 prior lines of therapy and have progression of disease within 60 days of last regimen. No prior BCMA-targeted treatment was allowed. Median number of prior regimens in this cohort was 6, ranging from 3 to 12. Significant portion of patients also had prior exposure to autologous stem cell transplant, 73%, allogeneic transplant, 10%, Revlimid or lenalidomide 100%, pomalidomide 84%, bortezomib 100%, carfilzomib 84%, and daratumumab 94%. 88% of patients were refractory to daratumumab, 17 to the last BI, 89% or 17 patients to the last BI, and 84% to the last IMID. Overall response rate of this bispecific T-cell engager was 88.9%. In a higher cohort, which was dosed 6 to 10 milligrams, dosing with VGPR response rate of 33.3%. CR/stringent CR response in the higher cohort of 10 milligrams included a response rate of 44%. So certainly good quality and deep responses in this early phase clinical trial. Lastly, we will touch base on selected ongoing or planned clinical trials exploring anti-BCMA CAR T-cell therapies in multiple myeloma. In this space, there's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing and that have been completed, but we will pay note to several clinical trials which have the most mature data and some of which have already been published. That includes CARTIFINI 1, a multi-center trial from China, which was a phase 2 trial of estimated 60 patients, a CARTITUDE 1 multi-center worldwide trial, which was a phase 1, phase 2 with over 100 patients enrolled, EVOLVE trial, which was a multi-center trial in the US, phase 1, phase 2, with also over 100 patients involved, and a KARMA trial, which was similarly multi-center worldwide clinical trial of 150 patients. All these patients, as can be seen, had to have at least 3 prior lines of therapy involving PIs and IMiDs and had to be exposed to these forms of therapies. Some of these trials had to also additionally have anti-CD38 therapy exposure, and they had to be experiencing disease progression in the last treatment within 12 months, for example, like in the CARTITUDE trial. Overall responses are as follows. In the KARMA trial, with 158 patients treated, overall response rate was 73%, with complete response of 33% and MRD negative response rate of 26%. Median time to response was 1 month, with the PFS reported thus far of 8.8 months. Safety profile included the CRS of 84% with grade 3 CRS of 4% and grade 4 less than 1%, with neurotoxicity rate of 18% and a grade 3 neurotoxicity of 3%. CARTITUDE reported on 29 patients with an overall response rate of 100% and a stringent complete response rate of 86%. Median time to response similarly in this patient cohort was 1 month or one treatment cycle. CRS rate was 93% with grade 3 CRS of 7% at least, and infusional neurologic side effects included a 10% rate with a grade 3 or equal rate of 3%. EVOLVE JCAR125 trial treated about 62 patients where overall response rate was reported at 92% with stringent complete response plus complete response overall response rate being 36% and MRD negative response rate in evaluable patients of 84%. PFS has not been reached yet in this clinical trial at a 6 month median follow-up. CRS was low at 3% with low rate of grade 3 CRS as well, and neurologic symptoms also were very low at 3%. Lastly, the updated results of the LEGEND 2 trial with LCAR B38M construct that reported on 57 patients reported an overall response rate of 89% with a stringent CR or CR response rate of 74% and an MRD negative rate of 68%. It should be noted that in terms of eligibility in this trial, patients required to be exposed to prior therapy which contained a PI and at least 3 prior lines of therapy. Time to response was similarly short, 1.1 months, with a PFS reported at a follow-up of 19.9 months and an overall survival of 36.1 months. CRS was 90% with a grade 3 or greater at 7%, and neurotoxicity was low at 2% with no grade 3 or higher neurotoxicity signals. At this point in time, I would like to have Dr. Callender take the next portion of the talk with the toxicity profiles of these therapies.
All right, thanks very much. So my portion is going to be talking about treatment emergent adverse events that are related to BCMA therapy, what to expect and how to manage them. So I wanted to start with a couple of case histories. These are two patients who both underwent CAR T transplant. On the left is a 55-year-old male with revised ISS stage 3 multiple myeloma. Treatment is listed there. And this patient underwent a BB2121 CAR T transplant. In about 12 hours post-infusion, spiked a temperature to 101, heart rate of 110, blood pressure of 120 over 80, but overall the patient is fine and the O2 saturation is normal. On the right, though, is a patient 59 years old with revised ISS stage 2 myeloma diagnosis, but who's clearly been through many different treatments, also receiving a CAR-T transplant. In 36 hours, this patient post-transplant spikes to temperature 102, heart rate of 130, blood pressure 78 over 50. Creatinine has bumped to 2.1 milligrams per deciliter from normal. The patient is disoriented and an O2 saturation on room air is 85%. Now, both of these patients actually have cytokine release syndrome, but they're obviously in different situations. So cytokine release syndrome is defined as a systemic cytokine-driven inflammatory state that results from the activation and expansion from T cells that can be, say, as part of a CAR-T or other cellular therapies that activate T cells. And it can range from an extremely mild problem to one where it's really life-threatening. And the action does not just involve the T cells themselves, but also host immune cells are brought into play, such as dendritic cells and macrophages. And some of the key cytokines that are involved include IL-6, IL-1, IL-10, TNF-alpha, and interferon gamma among others. And these cytokines act to have profound effects throughout a number of body systems. So besides fever, which is really one of the defining symptoms, there can be effects on lungs such as pulmonary edema and hypoxia. The GI tract, you can see diarrhea, nausea and vomiting, and anorexia. Patients can have acute kidney injury, not uncommonly. Myopathy is also possible, including myositis and actually rhabdomyolysis. Liver failure can be seen. Cardiac events include tachycardia, but also troponin leaks and even carditis as well. And finally, cytopenias are extremely common. And in terms of CNS events, patients can present with confusion, like the second patient, but also seizure can happen, and then obtundation as well. Now, there are markers that we can follow to decide if somebody is having CRS besides clinical symptoms. And very commonly, patients who develop CRS have cytopenias, including neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. In addition, markers such as C-reactive protein and ferritin are elevated. And if you look at grades of CRS, typically patients with the highest grade have the most profound deregulation or perturbation of these particular parameters. One note about ferritin is that patients who start off prior to whatever therapy they're receiving with a ferritin above 1500 seem to be more at risk to develop CRS. Similarly, in terms of coagulation abnormalities, patients often present with prolonged INRs and PTTs. Patients can have profound hypofibrinogenemia if they do have severe CRS grade 4, and also D-dimers can be quite elevated. And as you can see also from the previous graph and this one, these perturbations can actually last quite a bit of time. Now, there have been a number of different grading systems when we talk about CRS, and so that about a year and a half ago, the American Society for Transplant and Cellular Therapy decided to try to consolidate some of these grading systems and come up with something that would provide a common language. And basically, what they really did is throw out some of the organ-specific grading parameters and basically left it with fever, hypotension, and hypoxia. And then grades of CRS progress as you develop one after another of these symptoms and findings. So grade 1 CRS includes fever, grade 2 mild hypoxia, grade 3 requiring a vasopressor plus additional oxygen, and a grade 4 requiring unit support, including intubation, as well as multiple pressors. They also did the same thing for the grading of what is known as cytokine release encephalopathy syndrome, and basically developed what's called ICANS, which stands for immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome. And this involves first calculating an ICE score, and this is asking the patient several parameters such as their orientation, naming three objects, following some simple commands, writing a sentence, and then counting, and therefore the patient gets an ICE score between 0 and 10. And then They go on to be graded. So based on that ICE score, as well as other signs and symptoms, including are they awake or not? Are they having seizures? Are there any motor findings? Or is there elevated intracranial pressure or cerebral edema noted? And again, the grading goes from 1 to 4. Now, in comparison with other grading systems, the AST-CT grading system holds up pretty well. The one outlier here in green on the left bar graph is from Penn. They relied primarily on some organ system grading. And the CRS, the ICANS, also lines up pretty well. So I think most of the studies are going to try to utilize this ACT-CT grading system for clarity. Now, let's look at some of the specific incidences of CRS. So Mohammed mentioned in the previous talk that side effects are quite common in CAR-T trials. But if you look at the table on the left, most of these are actually hematologic problems. So the majority of patients do develop neutropenia, anemia, and thrombocytopenia, but non-hematologic grade 3-4 toxicity is relatively uncommon, as shown on the graph on the right. Now, if we specifically focus on CRS, actually lots of patients develop CRS, 84% in this KARMA trial that was updated at ASCO this year, but only about 5% of patients really have grade 3 or higher CRS. So tocilizumab that is used to block IL-6 was delivered in 52% of patients, and about 15% of patients also received steroids. Similarly, in the CARTITUDE 1 trial that Mohammed alluded to, again, same pattern, and this is seen pretty much in all CAR-T trials where the hematologic toxicity is often grade 3 with that neutropenia and thrombocytopenia, but the non-heme toxicity is usually fairly manageable. And in this particular study, CRS of some grade occurred in 93% of patients, but again, only 7% had grade 3. One thing that's demonstrated here is if you look at the KARMA trial using BB2121, the median time to onset of CRS was about a day. In CARTITUDE, using the J&J4528, the median time to onset is 7 days with a duration of 4 days. And in this particular trial, 79% of patients received tocilizumab and 21% received anakinra, the IL-1 blocker, or corticosteroids. Now, in terms of toxicity management, one of the principles is patient selection up front. It's difficult in myeloma because many of the patients, as Dr. Holstein alluded to earlier, these are patients who are often heavily pretreated and we really are looking for therapies. So some of them will really have some abnormalities in terms of lab studies at the beginning. We still try to pick people who have reasonable performance statuses. And we also want to try to have some hematologic function. Many of the studies require platelets of at least 50 to 75 and an ANC of 1,000. There isn't really a lymphocyte cutoff in most of these studies, but we don't want any signs of active infection and particularly not active viral infections such as hepatitis B, C, or HIV. And then reasonable organ function, so again, an injection fraction of about 45%, creatinine clearance at least 30 mils or above. In terms of toxicity, should it arise, we, as shown in the first couple of panels, you want to be looking at CRP and ferritin and hematologic parameters and evidence of coagulopathy. You also have to keep in account that maybe some of the laboratory derangement is actually coming from tumor lysis, and so this is something to keep in mind. Most studies ask for either prophylaxis with anti-epileptic drugs such as Keppra, but if they aren't on it and patients look like they're developing CRS, it would be a good time to start them. And most patients are asked to receive bacterial, fungal, and viral prophylaxis. But again, one thing to remember that particularly as these patients are neutropenic and febrile, they should also be covered for bacterial infections as well. Once a patient has CRS, typically daily labs are required. And depending on the product, some of these patients are going to be inpatients with monitoring happening. And for those receiving outpatient treatment, they will be asked to come into the clinic each day or actually admitted. Now, in terms of treatment, primarily the two drugs that are being used are tocilizumab and steroids. And again, as the grades go up, so does the intervention. Grade 1 CRS, typically supportive care only or possibly steroids. And then on up with grade 2, tocilizumab, and so forth, as you can see in this particular table. For neurotoxicity, steroids are really thought to be very important and should be started early. And again, for patients who might have both, usually the combination is given. You always want to rule out alternative causes and do so on an ongoing basis. And steroid dosing tends to vary from protocol to protocol. One other important thing to keep in mind, since again, these steroids are neutropenic, if they are going to be on a prolonged course of steroids, appropriate fungal prophylaxis against an invasive mold should also be considered. Now, one question that's come up in CAR T trials and other trials involving T cell products is, are steroids bad? In other words, are steroids going to make those CAR T cells or those other T cells go away? And this is a very interesting study published recently looking at patients with B cell ALL receiving anti-CD19 CAR Ts. And what you can show, what is shown here in the graph on the bar graph on the right in particular, is if you look at patients who either received steroids in the blue bars or didn't receive steroids at all in the red, both looking at T cell numbers immediately post-infusion and then at 2 and 3 months, there seems to be no particular detriment in terms of survival of these CAR Ts, leading, I think, many people to conclude that the use of steroids is probably not detrimental and may be a good thing to consider early on. Now, bispecific engagers, as Mohammed mentioned, have the same issue with CRS. The pattern's a little different, though, so I won't repeat some of the data that he showed. High incidence in the CC93269 product of CRS, but the pattern is that with the first dose, that's where you see most of the CRS, and then with subsequent doses, the incidence goes down so that by the third or fourth dose, you're hardly seeing any CRS at all. And this may be very important once these drugs become commercially available, so it's possible that there might be a lead-in where patients are actually hospitalized for the first couple of doses, but as they continue on these products, that they can be monitored as an outpatient. Similarly, the grade of CRS is actually fairly mild in this study. Only 3% of patients had grade 3 or higher CRS, and this data is very similar to what was presented at ASCO on teclistamab as well. Now, the bispecific, the antibody drug conjugates, as mentioned, keratopathy has been the side effect of most noteworthiness, I guess. The CRS incidence with these antibody drug conjugates is actually quite low, a couple of percent. But keratopathy seems to occur with belantamab in a fairly high frequency. In DREAM 2, that was 27% of patients. And what keratopathy is symptomatically is typically dry eyes or blurry eyes. And this is occurring in about at least a quarter of the patients at a grade 3-4 level and requires usually a dose hold. On the right here is a picture from a cornea showing that these patients get microcyst-like epithelial changes. And right now it looks like the best way to manage this is with a dose hold. There was a small study done looking at the effect of steroid eye drops in preventing this kind of toxicity, and that really seemed to be ineffective. So in conclusion, CRS is very common following typically CAR T transplants, and it's also quite common following bispecific engager therapy, but it's pretty rare, at least it seems so now, with antibody drug conjugates. Life-threatening CRS and CRES, or ICANS, is fortunately much less common. And early intervention is probably very important in keeping patients from progressing. We should never forget basics of just good oncologic care, so empiric therapy for neutropenic fevers, steroid-receiving patients should have antifungal coverage. Preparation is probably really a key here so that most centers who are doing these kinds of T-cell therapies have their tocilizumab on hand, they have their pharmacists working, they have their ICUs ready, their ERs ready to admit these patients if they've come in. And finally, I think that there is now agreement that steroids are probably not detrimental to CAR T-cell survival. And I'm going to turn it back to Dr. Holstein. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Callender, for that excellent summary. Before we delve into our panel discussion, I just have a few slides talking about what we know about resistance mechanisms and sequencing of these BCMA-directed therapies. And the spoiler is that we don't know a lot. So this is a figure from a CAR T-cell review, but some of this is relevant to other BCMA-directed therapies aside from CAR T-cells. So here the authors have broken down potential mechanisms into three classes. One are CAR T cell intrinsic. So remember that for many of these studies that have involved BCMA CAR T cells, these are very heavily pretreated myeloma patients. So their T cells might not be as fresh and active as we would like them to be and might have issues with persistence and T cell exhaustion, especially once inside the body. There are also myeloma cell intrinsic mechanisms of resistance, and one major one appears to be loss of BCMA from the cell surface. Now, this could be occurring through either downregulation of BCMA expression or through cleavage of BCMA leading to the soluble BCMA. And this mechanism of resistance in particular would be relevant for all three of the classes that we've discussed, as all three of these classes really depend on being able to bind BCMA at the cell surface and not be sopped up in the serum instead. And then there are also microenvironment issues as well. We know that the microenvironment in myeloma is very complex and that there are a variety of immunosuppressant ligands and cells which might be suppressing either the activity of the CAR T cells or the patient's native T cells with respect to the bispecific therapies. I wanted to touch on just one therapeutic strategy to overcome one of these potential mechanisms of resistance, and that's targeting the gamma secretase. So if we recall, during my introductory slides, I mentioned that BCMA can be cleaved from the cell surface. And so in this cartoon, the cleavage enzyme is shown by the little scissors icon, and this is the gamma secretase. So it cleaves the extracellular domain of BCMA, leading to the soluble BCMA. And again, the soluble BCMA can interact with the CAR T cell or with the ADC or with the bispecific agents. And if it's interacting with the if those agents are interacting in the serum instead of at the cell surface, then they're not going to be effective. So a potential way to overcome this would be to use an agent which blocks the activity of the gamma secretase and therefore leads to a decrease in the soluble levels of BCMA and an increase in the cell surface BCMA levels. So an interesting proof of concept study was presented at this past year's ASH by Dr. Cohen and colleagues. This was a phase one study where they used an oral gamma secretase inhibitor in combination with BCMA CAR T cells. Notably, they had seven patients, and they included two patients who had previously received prior BCMA therapy. The study was designed so that patients got an initial three doses of the gamma secretase inhibitor, and they were able to show that this led to an increase in cell surface BCMA levels and a decrease in soluble BCMA levels. Following the oral administration of the gamma secretase inhibitor, patients then went on to receive the CAR T cells. And although this is a very small number of patients, it was very encouraging that they saw 100% overall response rate. So I think this is very intriguing, and this therapy could be relevant not only for BCMA CAR T cells, but certainly you could envision using it to try to enhance the activity of bispecific agents and even ADCs as well. So what do we know about sequencing anti-BCMA therapies? Truly, we know very, very little. And that's in part because the majority of the clinical trials that have been conducted thus far that you've heard about today have purposely excluded prior BCMA therapy. So this includes the phase two DREAM-2 study, which is currently being evaluated by the FDA. This includes many of the bispecific antibodies, as well as several of the key CAR T cell players. So all we really have at this point are anecdotal reports. We have an interesting report from Dr. Cohen and colleagues published last year showing two patient examples where they received serial treatment of BCMA-directed therapies. The first patient was very heavily treated and initially received a phase one study of BCMA CAR T cells and only achieved a minimal response. Although if you look over on the right, the red line represents the serum M spike and the blue line represents the light chain. So you can see that after CAR T cell therapy, the lambda light chains decreased very dramatically, but then unfortunately the patient progressed. Subsequently then, the patient was put on a phase one study of belantamab. And here again, you can see that there is an initial decrease in the lambda light chains and a minimal response with respect to this intact M protein. The second patient they presented also was very heavily pretreated. Here they first received belantamab, but unfortunately progressed. They then received bridging therapy with pembrolizumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, and then were enrolled in a phase one study of BCMA CAR T cells where they did have a partial response. Some other little bit of data that we have from this past ASH comes from a Chinese CAR T cell study in which they used a fully human BCMA CAR T cell construct. Notably, 4 out of the 16 enrolled patients had previously relapsed on a murine BCMA CAR T cell trial, and all 4 of these patients then subsequently responded to this fully human BCMA CAR T cell construct. So certainly there's little glimpses that perhaps there is rationale for using one BCMA therapy after a different one has failed, but clearly we're going to need much more data to understand how to sequence these therapies. So with that, now I'd like to turn it over to our panelists today to talk about some of these issues. And I think one of the key questions that's on everybody's mind is how we're going to fit in these BCMA-directed therapies into the current treatment paradigm for myeloma. So I guess more specifically, my first question for my colleagues would be, which patients do you think would be most appropriate for an ADC versus a bispecific versus a CAR T-cell, assuming that we are living in a world where all three types of therapies were FDA approved? Dr. Callender, you want to take a stab?
Sure. I mean, I think one thing that Mohammed alluded to, which is really important, is that both antibody drug conjugates and bispecific engagers are right there. And so particularly if patients are relapsed and refractory and quite symptomatic, they often don't have the time, at least with the current technology, for a CAR T cell to be manufactured and are really looking for a solution right away. So I think particularly assuming that belantamab is approved, I think that is going to be a very widely used product right now. I don't know what you all think about that.
Dr. Balievich.
Absolutely agree with Dr. Callender regarding this notion. I think one of the things that we have all learned being involved in these trials with some of our patients is that, unfortunately, the time necessary for generation of CAR T cells can sometimes be just enough for patients to progress. By definition, these trials allowed only bridging forms of therapy that included only therapies that patients have previously already been exposed to, not allowing a novel forms of therapy to be used. So I personally had a patient who lost candidacy and who had a choice of joining a trial with belantamab, for example. So I think there's going to have to be some careful and judicious clinical decision-making that we're going to have to do for our patients to try to determine as best as we can what is the group of patients that might be able to last and wait for the time generation time that the autologous CAR T cells will require, and what are those that are probably better off relying on these sort of off-the-shelf ready forms of BCMA therapies. One more thing to mention, of course, and I think it's been alluded to in today's talk, is that we are potentially heading towards the future where we might even have allogeneic CAR T cells that are targeting myeloma epitopes available. So certainly these level of considerations will then no longer be an issue. But as you, Dr. Holstein, mentioned, this is really still very much an explored area where we're going to start seeing a greater number of patients once these therapies enter market, and we no longer just rely on small case studies, as you have showed, you know, in terms of efficacy of one BCMA therapy after another.
And assuming that you had a patient whose disease was controllable enough that you could think about CAR T cell, is there a reason that you would pick a bispecific over a CAR T cell or vice versa? Dr. Callender?
Well, we've been fortunate enough to have a couple of the studies with belantamab open, and some of the patients have had just really outstanding responses. I think it would be lovely to understand exactly who that's going to be if we could figure that out, but it's obviously a much easier therapy. It's outpatient. When CAR T transplants go well, I think it's, you know, it seems like a very reasonable therapy, but there is a lot of morbidity involved with it. And I think that's something, I think the result of some of the more upfront studies such as CARTITUDE 4 and I think KARMA 3, I think they're really going to teach us something about whether the effort that is required to have a patient go into a CAR T program makes sense in comparison with other available therapies.
Okay. And Dr. Balievich, any additional thoughts?
One of the KARMA trials actually in its design is involving the use of therapies that are even that are available for patients, for example, that have progressed within 18 months following the use of autologous stem cell transplant consolidation, or those that were not fit for transplant that have also progressed within that same time frame, or even for individuals who failed to achieve VGPR or greater response depth after induction. So I think that particularly data of this type, so here we are in this trial here, so in the KARMA 2 trial here that's shown on this slide with these cohort 2 subgroups, I think it's going to be particularly valuable once we get more information on these individuals as well, because certainly this will involve assessing the efficacy and safety profiles in patients at earlier lines of therapy. And surely we also have a number of clinical designs that are in planning that will attempt to bring the utility of CAR T cells at earlier opportunities. So I think we will learn a lot about what type of patterns of expression and safety profiles we're seeing. And I think that will also raise interesting questions about what in the end we will have to do for these patients who progress, and certainly the mechanisms that you have shown in some of the case reports will be very important, as well as other epitopes that are targeted by either bispecific T-cell engagers or CAR T-cell therapies.
And Dr. Callender, are there patients who might have certain comorbidities where you would think, no, this patient really should not even be considered for CAR T-cell therapy?
Well, I mean, I think you certainly would like to have your patients ambulatory and, you know, again, just sort of some baseline ability to do ADLs. The issue comes up is that we all, I think, would agree on this panel that more and more we're seeing patients who have very refractory disease, but still have the performance status that you want to try to give them another therapy. I would certainly say a person with a PS above 3, unless you could, you're completely convinced that it's only related to myeloma and nothing else, I would be nervous about that person, but certainly I think most of us would want to have patients who really can perform at least minimal ADLs before considering a CAR T, but I don't know what you both think.
Dr. Balibich?
Dr. Holstein, I would like to hear what you think, actually, here as well.
Yeah, you know, I think we aren't clear yet. You know, I think the impulse is to think about, well, if they were strong enough to be considered for an auto transplant, then perhaps we should also be able to consider them for a CAR T. But the two are obviously not equivalent. So I think we're still learning. You know, with autologous stem cell transplant, all of us have a age threshold where we at least start to get very nervous. And I don't think at this point that we quite understand whether that same age threshold or comorbidity index is the same for CAR Ts as it is for autologous stem cell transplant or even allogeneic stem cell transplant. So we're all in the learning phase, I think, at this point. And then I guess for community providers out there, once these agents do become available, do you recommend that before they start any of these agents for their heavily relapsed refractory patients that they get referred to a myeloma center of excellence or a transplant center of excellence for an opinion first?
I would certainly agree with that, and partly because, and I'm sure you both have had this experience as well, we've had some patients who've been referred where the local provider, I think perhaps not understanding what it might take to have a patient go through CAR T, has sort of been waiting as kind of like the last thing that we will then refer them in, and by the time the patient then shows up, there's too many obstacles. You know, again, the hematologic parameters are too low, or the patient's now really, you know, failing. So of course we would always encourage people to refer them in early for consideration of clinical trials and cellular therapy.
Okay, excellent. Any last minute points that either of you would like to make today?
I would just like to say this is one of the most exciting times, I think, in multiple myeloma treatment that, you know, 20 years ago, we were sort of scrounging around for different drugs or different formulations of drugs. We have so many things now we can offer patients. And there's just, I think it just, that's in it itself great. I think all of us here have many patients now who are 10 plus years out from their original diagnosis. That used to be amazing. And now it's become sort of routine. I think we're all very excited to learn about these therapies and what we can do to make them work better. So this has just been a great time, I think.
Absolutely agree. Dr. Balibich, any last thoughts?
I will just make two quick points relating to what Dr. Callender alluded to earlier. I think it's very important that there's going to be a little bit of work left to talk in general about the relevance and importance of CAR T-cell therapy, not just for very high-risk patients. It seems to me that sometimes the reason for delay is that perhaps some providers think that the CAR T-cell is only reserved for very high-risk patients and not standard-risk patients. Certainly, by definition, when they're refractory to these grades, as these trials are accruing, these are already high-risk patients. And it's going to be important, as was mentioned, to try to refer them, you know, as soon as possible so that we can try and appropriately plan and develop strategies that can be timely for these patients and not find ourselves in situations where we lose opportunity to administer and deliver a certain form of therapy because of the timing factor.
So I want to thank Drs. Valjevic and Callender for joining me today and for participating in this panel discussion. Thank you, everybody who participated in this activity.